Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. On today's program, we're going to review the prevention, detection, and treatment of gynecologic cancers with gynecologic cancer specialist, Dr. Joni Hope. I think it's pertinent to point out and maybe critical to note that the finding of a virus, a human papillomavirus, is a cause of cervical cancer, and its close association with other gynecological cancers has led to the development of a vaccine called the HPV vaccine. This in turn has led to the prevention of infection with this virus, and as a consequence of decreased infection, the rate of HPV-related cancers such as cervical cancer have generally trended downward. Dr. Hope is founder of the Alaska Women's Cancer Care, where she and others manage the surgical and chemotherapeutic aspects of women's cancers. In 2012, she founded Let's Let Every Woman Know Alaska, a nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness about gynecologic cancers throughout the state of Alaska. Dr. Hope, it's good to have you back again.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
For those of you who are listening and perhaps have never listened before, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us before we get started. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's start by having you tell us a little bit about Alaska Women's Cancer Care, what you do, kinds of practice or cancers that you're involved with, and who you work with.
Certainly. Well, Alaska Women's Cancer Care is a dedicated gynecologic oncology cancer practice. We're the only dedicated gynecologic oncology practice in the state of Alaska. And that means that we take care of women who have below-the-belt cancers, cancers of the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries, the cervix, the vagina, the vulva, and the lining of the abdomen called the peritoneum. We have two board-certified gynecologic oncologists, myself and Dr. Melissa Hardesty, as well as other highly trained gynecologists who assist us in our practice. And we basically provide all of the surgical and chemotherapeutic management of gynecologic cancer.
What is the most common gynecologic cancer that you're dealing with today?
Well, the most common type of gynecologic cancer is endometrial cancer, which is a cancer of the lining of the uterus. It's not the most deadly type of gynecologic cancer. In terms of endometrial cancer, it's about 60,000 new cases a year, and about, say, 10,000 deaths from endometrial cancer in the United States. That's estimated for 2016. The most deadly type of gynecologic cancer is ovarian cancer, and with ovarian cancer, we include fallopian tube cancer and primary peritoneal cancer, which is a cancer of the lining of the abdomen, because those cancers are all highly related, and we treat them the same. And while there's only 22,000 cases approximately new, there's almost 14,000 deaths. So the number of women who die from ovarian cancer is higher than from endometrial cancer. And the reason for that is that endometrial cancer is generally a cancer that we're very successful when women know the signs and the symptoms of catching early, treating early, and often curing with surgical intervention. Whereas ovarian types of cancers, unfortunately, there is no screening test for, and their signs and symptoms are very vague. And usually, unless we're very lucky, we find it when it's already spread, mm-hmm. Which means there's still treatment for it and very good quality of life that can be achieved. However, cure is much harder to attain.
So probably would have got the question right on the test, what was the most deadly, because I was aware that ovarian, like pancreatic cancer, is a late presenting because of lack of symptoms and lack of screening tests.
That's true. However, unlike pancreatic cancer, women live for years with advanced ovarian cancer. Hmm. And actually, while they present many times with what we call stage three or even stage four cancer, which means the cancer has spread throughout the abdominal cavity and sometimes beyond the abdominal cavity, even though that is usually when they present to us, our patients present to us, through the combination of surgery and chemotherapy, about 80% of the time we can achieve a total remission. Meaning that if we were to operate on women after they've gone through that primary therapy, we could find no pathological evidence of any cancer. Now, that does not mean that's different than achieving a cure. Mm-hmm. In 90% of those women, it will come back at some point, but not 100%. Not 100%. So there are some women who achieve long-term remission, and many achieve months and even years of remission from that primary therapy. And then once it does return, it becomes something that we have to treat like a very bad chronic disease with periods of treatment, a balance between chemotherapy and new targeted biological therapies, sometimes surgery, periods of treatment, periods of not being on treatment. But women do live with advanced ovarian cancer with good quality.
It seems to me that last point that you're making about the ability to almost make ovarian cancer a chronic disease, in a sense, is a theme we're hearing more and more and more from cancer. It used to be that there was this war on cancer and not much was happening to win the battle, but it seems like that tide has turned. Am I overstating it, or is that fair to say?
Well, I would love to see longer lifespans coming from the treatments that we're developing. But there's certainly many, many new approaches being researched and some exciting new therapies that are underway. Mm-hmm. But I do think you hearken to a really important point, which is that it's certainly in my practice, it is not about, you know, cure or no cure. There's not like this clear line that, okay, you're curable and you're not. It's much more of, okay, let's achieve the absolute best quality of life over the longest period of time that we can. And let's work together in a partnership to figure out what the next step should be given the problem that we're contending with. So in that sense, you know, quality of life considerations are essential, as well as really going after the cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that we're not going hard against the cancer. It's that you really have to balance, okay, this is going to be a lifelong battle. So when we're in that situation, which is not always, but when I am in the situation where we're not going to necessarily achieve a cure, but we're going to try to keep this going with quality as long as we can, it becomes a balance of what treatment now and sequencing those treatments. And that's the case with advanced recurrent ovarian cancer, but it's the case with any recurrent gynecologic cancer. Mm-hmm. Once it comes back, it becomes, you know, a process of periods of treatment and hopefully periods of remission.
When we get back to your mentioning that uterine cancer was the most common, ovarian cancer the most deadly or the most likely to die of, I was also going to say I would have missed the question about which was the most common. We hear so much about cervical cancer that I would have probably said cervical cancer was the most common gynecologic cancer, but that's not correct.
There's about 13,000 new cases in the United States of cervical cancer. However, in the world, there's about 500,000 cases, and in a quarter of a million women will die from cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. Cervical cancer is a very significant problem, and it's also a cancer that we can screen for and catch early. But the exciting thing about cervical cancer is that it's a cancer that we can actually prevent from ever happening. Mm-hmm. It's actually a cancer that we could eradicate because it stems from a virus, a sexually transmitted virus. And that's the human papilloma virus. So if we were to immunize with a human papillomavirus vaccine, all of our young people at the appropriate age, in the appropriate manner, we could conceivably eradicate cervical cancer, prevent it from being a problem that any young person, any or older person needs to contend with.
Definitely want to come back to HPV, human papillomavirus, and the vaccine, and certainly answer questions that callers may have. But let's clarify, at least if I'm right, that ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer are not HPV-related cancers.
No, they're not.
So what's the cause, what's felt to be the cause of those two cancers?
Well, we don't know the cause of all of those cancers. We certainly know risk factors associated with those cancers. There are genetic syndromes that predispose people to higher risks of both ovarian and endometrial types of cancers. The most famous for ovarian are the BRCA mutations, which elevate your lifetime risk of a cancer, not just ovarian cancer, but we're discussing ovarian cancer, from, say, 1.3% in the general population to as high as 20 to 40%. And that comes from a heritable gene mutation that runs in families. So essentially, if my mother had a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, I would have a 50% chance of inheriting it myself. So there, ovarian cancers are thought to about 15 to 20% of ovarian cancers are thought to be genetic, and that's not just BRCA, but all of genetic mutations. Okay. And then the other 80%, if you will, some of those may be unknown gene mutations, and many of them may just be, you know, the luck of the draw, so to speak. We don't have the answers. Mm-hmm. In terms of endometrial cancer, again, there are some genetic syndromes that do elevate one's risk for endometrial cancer. Lynch syndrome, HNPCC, which is a syndrome that involves not just endometrial but colorectal cancers and ovarian elevated risk as well. That's an example of something that does elevate your risk, and we do look for that whenever we have a diagnosis of an endometrial cancer. But there's also known risk factors for endometrial cancer. It's a cancer, the most common type of endometrial cancer. That's the lining of the uterus, cancers that grow from the glandular cells lining the uterus. The most common reason is a estrogen excess of some type. And that can come from obesity. And as obesity is an enormous problem in our population, essentially the peripheral conversion of adipose tissue into estrogen, and then estrogen increases in the circulating bloodstream, that acts on the estrogen receptors lining the uterus, causing an overgrowth. So obesity and endometrial cancer go hand in hand. And it's very, very important to address obesity in all of its all of the problems that it causes in our patients. Even if we cure the endometrial cancer, let's say my next goal often is to then discuss, okay, now that we've had this brush with cancer, let's address obesity, because obesity is likely to cause your mortality more quickly than the cancer that we just took care of.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Joni Pope, or Hope, I'm sorry. She's the founder of Alaska Women's Cancer Care. She deals with the surgical and chemotherapeutic aspects of gynecologic cancer. If you've got questions or comments, here's how you can reach us over the next 45 minutes or so right now. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Email address line1, LINEONE, at alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So to summarize, we've talked about the three most common gynecologic cancers: endometrial cancer, which has some genetic risk. It may be associated with the estrogen excess, but in general, we're not sure exactly why that's such a common cancer, but obesity may play a role.
No, it definitely plays a role. Okay. We are quite sure why we're seeing so much endometrial cancer related to obesity.
It is.
Has
okay.
to do with estrogen excess. Okay. There are some endometrial cancers that are genetically related. But endometrial cancer itself is, the link between obesity is firmly established.
Okay. Yeah. And then there's ovarian cancer, which there may be a clear, well, there is a clear link between some genetic syndromes, particularly the BRCA, which causes increased risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer in women. And then we've got cervical cancer, which we're very certain is the vast majority, if not all, cervical cancers are caused by HPV virus. So let's talk about human papillomavirus in particular. Is it the only cancer that we know we can say without a doubt is caused by a virus now, or is that taking it too far? You think there are others?
There's many HPV-related cancers.
Right.
So while cervix is one of the HPV-related cancers, penile cancers, anal cancers, vulvar and vaginal cancers, and increasingly oropharyngeal cancers can be associated with HPV.
Yeah, I didn't say that, but ask that question very right. I was trying to get at is, are there other known cancer viruses is clearly associated with with different kind of cancers, including the ones you mentioned, other than HPV? HPV is the really clear cancer-causing virus.
Certainly in my world.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And so there's a number of, and so this is a sexually transmitted problem, it sounds like.
Yes. So HPV is a sexually transmitted infection, but you have to understand that it's ubiquitous in the sense that it happens to virtually all of us. Mm-hmm. If you are a sexually active human being, you will be exposed to HPV. It's estimated that 80% of people will be infected with HPV. And the exposure can occur with really any type of intimate sexual contact, not just typical intercourse, if you will. It's intercourse, in fact, is not necessary to become infected. And it's also not correlated with the most recent sexual contact necessarily. It's something that can lie dormant for years and then rear its head later. Maybe you're at a time of increased stress or your immune system is lower. So it's something that really we don't want, should not, you know, cause shame, because it's like getting a cold. I mean, if you're a sexually active human being, you will have exposure to this virus. It's just out there that widespread.
I would say that you're going to be exposed whether you're sexually active or not, because the virus is the common cause of almost virtually all warts that we have. There are certain strains that may be associated with more sexual contact. So it's a quite ubiquitous virus in a lot of ways.
Right. And I'm talking about the type that's generally spread through the mucous membranes with genital to the genital, anal to genital, oral to genital type of a contact.
So it gets a little bit more complicated. It's not just HPV virus. There's different serotypes or slightly different kinds of HPV virus.
Correct. There's many different strains of HPV, and not all of those strains are oncogenic. You mentioned warts. There's strains that cause, very annoying but not cancer-causing genital warts. And then there's the strains that are actually, we know, to be dangerous in terms of their ultimate potential to cause a cancer.
So listeners may also think that there might be symptoms like with a cold so that they know they might be contagious. My understanding is the spreading of HPV virus actually may be associated with virtually no symptoms.
Correct. Because like many things, most of us, when we get exposed, our immune system fights it off.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know that you've been exposed. And the Pap test, which is how we screen for cervical cancer, is basically a test that's able to find abnormal cells at the cervix, the opening of the uterus, which is the cervix, that are slightly abnormal and precancerous. Those are the changes that are completely asymptomatic. They have no symptoms associated with them. They're just a little teeny cells that we see under a microscope after we do a brush of the cervix. So cervical cancer has symptoms, but not the HPV virus, or even the pre-cancer changes from the HPV virus.
So there's a couple of strains of HPV, 16 and 18 are the numbers. Physicians or scientists are very clever. They've named these by 1, 2, 3, 4, plus up over 100. But we know number 16 and 18 and a handful of others are the most common. So is it true then that everyone who gets an infection with one of these high-risk HPV viruses is going to go ahead and develop cervical cancer?
Absolutely not. So 16 and 18 account for about 70% of cervical cancers worldwide. And of the non-carcinogenic types of HPV virus, 6 and 11 are responsible for about 90% of the genital warts. And like I just mentioned, just to backtrack, there's about 13 HPV types that are designated as carcinogens. So the other 30% that cause cancer are the non-16, 18 types. There's about 11 types that have been identified. So most people, like I said, will fight with their robust immune system just to eradicate the virus. Mm-hmm. And so it's a risk to identify the virus and treat the virus aggressively in younger women and younger people, because that causes healthcare professionals to take action. We mm-hmm. see something wrong, we're going to take action. When we take action against with a precancer finding or a high-risk HPV finding on a younger person, we have a tendency to overtreat. Mm-hmm. And we do not want to overtreat, because overtreating the cervix often means we're cutting away at the cervix, and that puts young women at risk for birth complications, preterm deliveries in the future. Mm-hmm. So you want the immune system to have a chance to do its job. And most of the time, it does.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is the immune system does a good job, even against these oncogenic HPV viruses, in preventing it. But for reasons I guess we don't quite understand, or at least I don't understand, some people become chronically infected, and those are the individuals who may have more risk of cancer.
Some people have a difficult time fighting off an infection, right, and their immune system can't do it. Some people fight it off for years, and then out of the blue, even mm-hmm. though they haven't had a new sexual partner, they end up with an abnormal pap smear. Right. And some people who may have had extra stress in their lives, a lot of it has to do with, we think, with the strength of your immune system. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear exactly the why and the when. Certainly women who are immunocompromised are at higher risk. But that is the rationale for having a vaccine, just like any other virus, is that if you give a vaccine that can help somebody develop an immune response against the most dangerous types of HPV, then you can protect them from ever getting the infection that would cause the cancer.
So the algorithm is, if you can prevent the infection, then you don't have to worry about the treatment. You don't have to worry about which people are going to later, their immune system is not going to be able to protect them. So the next question would be, what's the risk-benefit ratio of the vaccine? And I guess if there's an argument that we occasionally hear about using the HPV vaccine and the timing of it, which is a slightly different issue, people may complain about why they have to give young pre-sexually active individuals the vaccine, but then is it safer? Is it safe enough to be doing that? What do we know about the safety, I guess, is where I'm trying to get in a very confounding way here.
Well, just to back up for a second, I think safety is important to address, but the reason why it's important to vaccinate our youth before they become sexually active is that when you give a vaccine, you want to provide that inoculus before they've had any exposure to the virus, mm-hmm. so that you can actually protect them. Mm-hmm. Once the exposure has happened, the vaccine is not as effective. So the ideal age is in the 11 to 12-year-old range, where the immune system is healthy, and prior to initiation of sexual activity, so that you can get the most protection from it. And we've seen, we have examples from other countries who have had wonderful success with the vaccine when they do vaccinate their young people, of being able to not only reduce the risk of genital warts, but of precancers, and ultimately, hopefully, wiping out cancer. And Australia is really sort of the model country for that.
So we also have the natural experiment, at least in Australia, that as the vaccine came on and a significant number of people started using it, the incidence of cervical cancer has decreased.
Yeah, and the way that happened, actually, in in Australia is that the First Lady developed cervical cancer. And so there was a very public person who developed the disease, and that was able to help destigmatize the cancer and influenced her husband into creating some helping initiate a national immunization program. And in that, and they had a very successful public media campaign. And after that, they developed a school program where they had universal vaccination in the schools, starting with the girls. And that, and they had phenomenal results. And they, I mean, they're continuing to see what those results are over time. When you're looking at the results of something like HPV vaccination over time, you have to look at what your endpoints are different. So one of it's easier to see a decrease in the rate of warts, if you will, and of precancer changes than of cancer, because cancer takes longer to develop.
So your Pap smear results may improve first.
Right. Yep. Right. Okay. Exactly. And rates of
genital warts.
Yes. Yeah. And their early outcomes. So in Australia, their early outcomes, they looked at HPV prevalence and genital warts, and then the middle years to decades range, they looked at the intraepithelial neoplasia, which are the precancers, and then the late outcomes, which are decades down, will be HPV associated cancers. But they really had a model program that's very, very successful.
As you came in, I mentioned that it was my impression that cervical cancer rates had been decreasing in general at least in Caucasians, at about 1% per year for a number of years, and even higher rates of decrease in Black Americans and other races. Unfortunately, not American Indians was my impression. But you corrected me and said most recently it's gone up. This most recently. So the question in my mind would be, why was it decreasing before we really had lots of exposure to the HPV vaccine? People may be wondering about that. And then why maybe a little bump recently?
Well, I'm not sure that you can actually correlate the decrease before the HPV vaccine and you know, correlate those two things exactly. But I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that question 100% because I don't really know the answer.
It wouldn't have to do with using the Pap smear is what I was wondering.
Well, you know, certainly education and education campaigns around the importance of screening and access to health care are all critical components of diagnosing the precancers early. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I don't really know the answer about why we're seeing an increase right now.
Okay.
I do know that in Alaska, we see a lot of late cervical cancer. And by late, I mean highly metastasized cancer that's no longer curable. Mm-hmm. And we see that across all populations. This is not, and I believe it has something to do with possibly a reticence of women to interface with the healthcare system and come access care in a timely manner, and more of a, you know, I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to, you know, live tough, live Alaskan. But it's really stunning. In the last even 2 or 3 months, we've had almost 5 or 6 new cases of very advanced cervical cancer. And it's such a tragedy because these are cancers that could have been prevented. And unfortunately, cervical cancer is a cancer that once it has spread, there really is no cure for that.
All right. We're already 30 minutes through the program. I did want to spend a lot of time on HPV vaccine because we have a preventable, and as I think you implied at the beginning of the show, we could completely eradicate potentially HPV-related cancers if we use that vaccine appropriately. But we need to continue to move on, and I want to remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number, 550-8433, and our email address, line1 at alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on gynecologic cancers with Dr. Joni Hope.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If you've been listening, you know our topic today is gynecological cancer. Particularly, I spent some time talking about cervical cancer, uterine lining cancer, endometrial cancers, and then the other cancer, ovarian cancer. We've talked about the human papillomavirus, which is shown to be the cause of cervical cancer and other sexually transmitted cancers involving the rectum and the penis, for example, and that this virus has a safe and effective vaccine and is a potentially we can eradicate these cancers. And my guest, Dr. Hope, mentioned that the evidence is quite clear, particularly in other countries like Australia, where they seem to be ahead of us in their ability to get people vaccinated for that. As I mentioned, our guest is Dr. Joni Hope. She's a female cancer specialist. If you have questions, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped recording. We won't be able to answer any questions, but you can go to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and listen to the program now or anytime that you would like to. Let's just briefly mention the most common symptoms that might bring a woman to the attention of a physician for endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer. And I'm saying that with the idea, as you've mentioned already, that the ovarian cancer may be kind of subtle in its presentation of symptoms, so that we can, what symptoms maybe women should be aware of before they typically want to come to somebody to be seen.
Well, with endometrial cancer, the far and away most important symptom is abnormal bleeding. And by abnormal bleeding, I mean any bleeding after menopause. I also mean bleeding in between your periods if you're premenopausal. And this does not mean that you have cancer. It's most likely that you don't have cancer, but it needs to be investigated because endometrial cancer presents with bleeding. So if somebody's period, let's say, stopped when they were 48 or 49 or 50, a year later they have a drop of blood, that should be evaluated. You should go to your primary care doctor or your OBGYN. You should say, hey, I had some bleeding, and I haven't had bleeding in a long time. If you're a 35-year-old woman and normally you get your periods every 28 days, and this month you got one after 12, that's something that needs to be evaluated. You need to know why. Why are you bleeding? Because when a cancer of the lining of the uterus grows, that growth, that cancer itself bleeds, and that blood comes out the cervix, and that's how you present with blood. That would be the most common risk factor and sign.
Okay. How about ovarian cancer?
Well, ovarian cancer, when you develop symptoms for ovarian cancer, like I mentioned earlier, it's usually that it's already spread. But that does not mean that you should not be aware of what these symptoms are, because the sooner that you come, the sooner that we can do something about it. But the signs of ovarian cancer are relatively vague. It might be generally fatigue, bloating, weight loss or weight gain, persistent nausea, constipation. You notice that your pants don't fit the way that they used to, and something just does not feel right. And many times women will go to their primary care doctor, and then they may go to a GI doctor, and they may go to a urologist, and they may have lots of tests before finally something is done that finds the answer. And usually that comes from an astute provider saying, well, let's get imaging. Let's take a look. And at the time of imaging, let's say by CAT scan, it's noted that there's a pelvic mass and fluid in the abdomen and evidence that there may be spread of the cancer. When we do catch ovarian cancer early, it's very often luck. It's because maybe a mass on the ovary caused pain, and somebody was very aware of that pain and or the change in their in what they normally feel like. And that's usually the message I try to give women, is that trust yourselves to know your bodies. If something does not feel right, get it checked out. It's probably fine, but get it checked out. Trust yourselves. So with early ovarian cancer, unfortunately, it's often luck that helps us find it. I had a patient come to me very early on when I moved to Alaska, who had gone to the state fair and ridden on that slingshot ride where, you know, flings you into the air and bangs you back down, and like a bungee jump in the double seat. You know, it's looks. And she ruptured her ovarian mass on that ride and presented with an acute abdomen, and that's how we found her ovarian cancer. And so, like, I was like, wow, I guess early diagnosis in Alaska is a whole new thing.
What about cervical cancer? What are the symptoms that might suggest cervical cancer?
Very commonly, cervical cancer will present with bleeding after intercourse, which makes sense if you think that you have a growth on your cervix. And if that growth is affected, then it can bleed. So again, abnormal bleeding, but that's a common sign. Sometimes it's pain, discomfort, irregular periods, abnormal discharge.
So we've mentioned the human papillomavirus and the vaccine, and women who have gone ahead, particularly early in life, and gotten the HPV vaccine may think that they no longer need to have screening for cervical cancer. And that raises the question, is what is the recommendation in the age of the HPV vaccine for pap smears?
The recommendation is still identical to everybody else. So there's no, at this point in time, change. If you've had a vaccine, you're less likely to have an abnormal pap smear, but you should still go to your doctor and follow the screening recommendations for pap smears, even if you've had the good fortune of having been vaccinated.
Okay. So just because you've got this protective vaccine at this particular time, the recommendation is continue to have pap smears as recommended.
Correct. And the age of the vaccine right now is approved between ages 9 and 25. Doesn't mean you can't get it later. It's just that those are thought to be the most effective ages for the vaccine. Again, the goal being to give it to boys and girls, not just girls, prior to the onset of sexual initiation.
So let's talk about that. I have four daughters, all of them, not all of them, all but one older than 26. And I mentioned they should get the vaccine. Are there any harm in getting the vaccine?
There's no harm at all in getting the vaccine at that age. They may have to pay for it, so it might be harmful to your pocketbook in terms of whether your insurance will cover it or not. But it just may, depending on what strains of HPV they've been exposed to, it may not be as effective, but it's not. There's not a contraindication to getting it.
Okie doke. All right. Got an email from a lady who says she's in her early 50s. Generally, her periods have gotten a little bit heavier, lasting a little bit longer, maybe a little bit more painful, particularly with backache. Is this something that should be checked? It seems like it's very similar to the points you made a minute ago about endometrial cancer. Or she says, is this potentially something serious or just an annoying fact of aging?
Well, it certainly could be just a normal menopause process, but I would say that if periods are becoming heavier and longer, that she should definitely go to her provider and say, I'd like to have this evaluated. And generally, that would start with a transvaginal ultrasound. And if there was an irregularity in the lining of her endometrial lining, the middle part of the uterus, which can be seen usually very clearly on an ultrasound, then she may or may not need a biopsy of the lining of her uterus to help reassure her. It's also possible that she's just going through change of life, menopause, and that's part of why menopause can be confusing to women. Is this normal or isn't it normal? And I would advise just go and talk to your doctor, go and talk to your nurse practitioner, your healthcare provider, and let them know.
There's another email that's come in, and I've read it, and we may not be able to answer this question. It may be a little bit confusing, but here it is. It's a woman. She says, I was diagnosed with HPV. After 2 years, I started to have normal paps. So I'm assuming she had abnormal pap smears before this. And then 1 year after having 2 years of normal paps, I had an abnormal pap smear again. After 6 months, I'm back to having normal pap smears. So this has been an on and off again situation. My doctor told me that I'm now testing negative for HPV virus. Does that mean that the virus is gone and will not come back? I'm not sure how the person was tested for HPV. Maybe you understand that better than me.
It means that the virus appears dormant, but it unfortunately does not mean that it won't come back. So it sounds like her immune system is doing a good job of fighting the virus, but that it rears its head now and then over the years. And that is how it happens, which is why I really stress that HPV is not something that you can point to the last person you've been involved with and say, hey, you gave me HPV. It just doesn't work like that. It's something that everybody is exposed to who is a sexual being. And even virgins have been found to have HPV. So it's something that it's a fact of life, and it can be prevented.
So potentially a girl could self-infect herself with putting a tampon in. Is that how that would happen?
Well, I think, like I said, it's not just sexual intercourse with a man and a woman that transmits the virus.
Okay.
It even hand to genitals, mouth to genitals, different types of contact have been shown to spread the virus. And actually, one of the cancers that's most on the rise is oropharyngeal cancer. There were 11,000 cases annually reported by the American Cancer Society in 2011, and 7,000 of those were in men. So it's actually been estimated that oropharyngeal cancer associated with HPV will be more common than cervical cancer by the year 2020. Yeah. So it's something that affects all of us, and it's...
The ear, nose, and throat surgeons that I've talked to point out that it's not the official reason for HPV vaccine, both in boys and girls, which we haven't mentioned, but it is recommended in boys and girls, but that the incidence of HPV-related oropharyngeal cancers is significant, and probably in the near future that'll be one of the recommendations for the reasons for this vaccine. I just haven't seen that as a particular definite reason at this point.
HPV-related tongue and tonsil cancers have more than doubled in the last 20 years.
The question from the lady about her negative HPV coming and going, this is somewhat for me and maybe for listeners. How is that being diagnosed that she had HPV or not? Is this being done by a genetic test on the material to see if there's evidence of that virus there? And if that's the case, can they tell what serotype of the virus is there?
So now when you get a pap smear, when you're in your 30s, the recommendation is that you don't just get screening of the cells that to see how abnormal they look under a microscope, but you can actually get genetic testing, DNA testing done to see if high-risk HPV is present. And you can get that HPV serotyped. So if, and the recommendations for pap smears are, have changed a lot, let's say, to put it very mildly, in the last 5 years, and can be very confusing. However, co-testing, meaning looking at the cytology or the cells under that you slough off when you do a pap smear, plus DNA testing for HPV, can be done together. And that co-testing recommendation is especially important for women once they're beyond their 20s. And when they're younger than their 20s, it's generally thought that you should just do the cytology testing without the HPV testing. The reason being, you do not want to overtreat. Overtreating is dangerous. So, and women will clear this, like this person who's called in, what may clear it on their own without making the intervention. As long as we prevent cancer from happening, you know, first do no harm is the goal as the provider. So the yes, you can figure out what type of HPV is present, and that's all done at the time of the analysis with pap smear. It's simple.
So that gets to this argument about PSAs and prostate cancer, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and mammography with breast cancer. There are times we may have a tendency to overdiagnose, and overdiagnose can lead to some problems. So that's interesting with the pap smear. And so we now can tell what serotype of virus, of HPV virus, is there, and we can, in a sense, monitor whether it and watch it kind of come and go and its activity with pap smears as well, it sounds like.
And, you know, while we have a vaccine that can prevent HPV from ever becoming a problem, and that, and it, just to clarify that just a little bit more, we mentioned that, you know, there are multiple types of human papillomavirus. It's, the vaccine is not, you know, the panacea. Right now we have a vaccine that will cover 9 strains of the HPV virus. And that's a mixture between the oncogenic or the cancer-causing strains and the non, the genital wart-causing strains. And it's now thought that in adolescents, we can just give 2 doses. It used to be 3 doses. We now believe it's safe to give 2 doses to achieve immunity. Those are spaced about 6 months apart, and ideally at the age of about 11 is a perfect age for boys and for girls. And so the reason I'm mentioning this is it's not that you might, it protects you from 9 types of HPV, but there's more than 9 types of HPV. So it's still possible to have a problem with it in the future, which is why you should still get your pap test done.
Another email. Would the presence of warts early in adolescence mean that HPV vaccine would not be effective, that the virus is already present? So I'm assuming that this individual is meaning genital warts. Warts everywhere else on your body are caused by HPV, but here we're talking, I'm going to make the assumption that the question is, if a person has genital warts early in adolescence, does that mean HPV vaccine would not be effective as the virus is already present?
No. So even if you've already started, there's been some sexual contact, does not mean that the virus will not, that the, sorry, that the vaccine will not be effective. Let me try to say that with fewer negatives. You should be vaccinated even if you've started to endeavor in sexual activity of some kind. So the presence of warts means that, yeah, you've been exposed to, of genital warts, I'm speaking about, one strain of HPV, but it doesn't mean that your body can't mount an immune response and gain benefit from being vaccinated against the more dangerous types.
We've spent some time now talking about HPV and cervical cancer, and I still want to continue to make sure listeners are hearing that endometrial cancer, uterine cancer, is much more common, and that ovarian cancer is more dangerous in the sense that it's more lethal when found. Is there anything else other than me just reminding everybody about that fact that we should discuss about ovarian or endometrial or other gynecologic cancers that come to mind?
Well, you know, the main thing I think is just opening the conversation mm-hmm. and even being aware, hey, you know, there are these cancers. There's cancers of the vulva and the vagina. Mm-hmm. There's cancers associated with pregnancies. So there's lots of different cancers that we don't necessarily speak about. And part of what I try to do and part of the reason why I helped start the organization Let Every Woman Know is to raise awareness about and open the doors to the conversation about these cancers, and that it's okay to talk about them and it's okay to ask, what, you know, is this normal and something doesn't feel right and how does my body even work? Because, you know, understanding what's normal is sort of a prerequisite to being able to identify what's not normal. And being able to talk about your body mm-hmm. is the first step.
We've talked about cervical cancer and prevention, particularly by using HPV vaccine. We've talked about some of the genetic screening. There's individuals who might be at risk for the genetic or for ovarian cancer due to some genetic reasons. And you mentioned obesity as a risk factor, a significant risk factor, I think you put it, for endometrial cancer. Are there other preventative things that women can do for GYN cancers that we haven't maybe mentioned that people might be thinking about or asking about?
Great question. So with ovarian cancer, actually oral contraception, birth control pills, reduces the incidence and the rates of ovarian cancer. So one of the things that we do with our known genetic mutation carriers who are in young women who are not ready to pursue a surgical option, meaning removal of their fallopian tubes and ovaries, that just birth control pills can help decrease the incidence of ovarian cancer. So that's one that many people may not know about. The other thing I would just say again is just knowing what your body it feels like normally, and knowing when there's something abnormal. In terms of, we haven't really touched at all on vulvar cancers, but you know, things, you can get melanomas of the vulva. You can get moles and spots that weren't there before and now they are, and those need to be evaluated without shame.
Just want to mention one more time, we're about 5 more minutes before the program's over. If you've got questions or comments to ask Dr. Hope, our local number 550-8433. And our toll-free number, then 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. There's still, unfortunately, resistance to the HPV vaccine. What are the common reasons that you hear about that people are resistant, and how would you answer that? Those concerns.
Well, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation available about the HPV vaccine, and there's certainly people who, you know, have issue with vaccination, period. So I think one of the areas of resistance is the fact that it's a vaccine and that there are people who feel wary of vaccines. But it's been studied, and this is absolutely been proven to be a safe vaccine. So the other reason I think that there's maybe more hype and concern and even more misinformation about the HPV vaccine out there is that it has to do with something that's difficult to talk about. I mean, it has to do with acknowledging the fact that someday young people are going to become sexual beings. Someday they're going to enter that world where they're going to have relationships. And you're talking about taking kids who your children, and I have a daughter, and thinking about who's 9, so she's not yet undergone vaccination yet, but it's basically, I have to think about, okay, this is somebody who I don't want to think about in that way, who someday is going to enter that world, and what can I do now to make her safe? And I think that that's a difficult thing to really grasp. As a parent who wants to protect our kids and keep them young and keep them, you know, safe. And so I'm guessing that there's concern about the fact that it has some intersection with that fact of life, mm-hmm. that our kids are going to grow up and they're going to become sexual beings.
Yeah, there was some concern at some point. I've heard that parents were worried that kids would become more sexually active if they got the vaccine. I'm not sure of the rationale for that, but that's actually been studied and not been found to be the case, for example. Are there other, what I put down on my questionnaire, dangerous misunderstandings or misinformation about gynecologic cancers other than misinformation about HPV vaccine that you run into?
Did you say other misinformation?
Yep, or misunderstandings.
About gynecologic cancers?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure that there are. I mean, there's certainly, I think that we have a tendency as women and as probably just as people in general, you know, to not want to think that there's something that might not be right with us. And I just go back to this statement that as women, knowing your body and being able to talk about what feels normal and what does not feel normal to you and trusting that that's the absolutely most important thing, because being able to detect these cancers early is all about presenting to somebody who can help find out what's going on. And all of the gynecologic cancers, which is true of any cancer, not just gynecologic, is that when you catch these cancers early, they are curable. And with less need for intervention. So trust yourself and get to a provider, get good information. I think that that's another thing that the internet is full of information that's not accurate, and knowing how to find good sources of information is really important. And Let Everyone Know's website has information, as does Alaska Women's Cancer Care. So does the Foundation for Women's Cancer, which is a national organization dedicated to gynecologic cancer research and awareness and education. So having good sources of information is critical.
Those links that Dr. Hope have mentioned are available at her website, and her website and other links to very reliable information are on our website at Alaska Public Radio, the Line 1 link. Dr. Hope, thanks for doing this again. This is your second time. I'm sure we will do it again in the future. It's been very helpful. I've learned some stuff. I'm sure our listeners have. And I appreciate everything you've been doing to try to help women understand gynecologic cancers.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
If anyone wants to continue this discussion, you know you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link at alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the link to the Line 1 archives, as I mentioned earlier. Next week, Line 1 will take a break for President's Day. The following week, we're going to return. We're going to talk about another cancer, colorectal cancer. So why not join us on Monday, February 27th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork was today's audio engineer. He also is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.